Hi there, folks, and welcome. Welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima McGinn, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Native Shark, which is an online platform for learning Japanese. And what Native Shark do is they make learning Japanese really, really simple. So you just show up, click a button that says study now, and the platform will then show you exactly what you need to learn next based on your progression. Now, this may sound simple, and in practice it is, but the way it's designed means that students who use Native Shark once a day for 4 to 5 months can complete the equivalent of over 2 years of university study. And what they're also unique in is that they teach all of the types of Japanese that you wouldn't normally get in traditional schools or textbooks. And if you've ever studied with one of the more common textbooks that foreigners usually pick up, you've probably noticed that there are a lot of sentences or conversations in there that you'd never really hear in real life, and vice versa. Some of the stuff you actually hear when you're out and about in Japan is never really covered in these traditional textbooks. So this isn't the case with Native Shark. It's very well grounded in everyday spoken Japanese, whether it's casual or formal language. And you can really expect, like one of the students writes in their reviews, you can really expect to be picking up the sort of little nuances that no one would expect a non-native speaker to use. And that's pretty rare for most Japanese courses. So yeah, really, really useful platform. And since you've heard about it here on the podcast, you also get an extra little bonus. If you sign up using the URL nativeshark.com/NTI, we'll link to it in this episode's show notes. That's native without an E, so N-A-T-I-V shark, all one word, .com/NTI. Use that link to sign up and you'll get a double-length free trial, so 2 weeks free instead of the one. And you can sign up for that free trial without having to put any credit card or anything of the sort in there. So give it a go. You won't regret it. So for today's episode, and I know I say this a lot, we've got a super deep dive into a whole bunch of topics again. So once more, this is a recording of our Wednesday Clubhouse chat room on the topic of real estate in Japan with Tokyo expat family home expert Emil Gorgis, short-term stay queen Tracy Northcott, and Akiya, or abandoned/vacant properties guru Matt Ketchum. And we take a whole lot of questions from the audience this time on a huge gamut of topics. So we answer questions about the incentives to investing in Japan, considering the declining population, the reasons behind the abandoned homes phenomena and how this affects the property market and tenant vacancy rates, a really detailed explanation of how to prepare for a potential future investment or family home loan application. And spoiler, you should really consider this a couple of years in advance. And we'll explain exactly why, and also about the different types of loans available, how they all work. We revisit the topic of investor versus business visas and how they can relate to property investments, if and when they do. We talk about how negotiations are conducted in Japan and what types of properties can be negotiated. We talk about the differences between the residential and commercial market here. What to do with your property and or bank account if you happen to leave the country at any stage. That's for those among you who are actually living in Japan, of course. We talk about whether it's better to invest in several cheaper properties or a single pricier property, where to buy, what kind of returns are achievable in all these different locations. And finally, we also touch on why exactly it is that people are so reluctant to move or relocate to a new home in Japan. So really diverse topics, and we tackle them all at great length, which is why this one's a pretty long episode, about 2 hours in total. So buckle in, enjoy the conversation, and I'll see you all again on the other side. Okay, so between the three of us and, again, Emil, who's a Tokyo agent who deals mainly in family homes for expats who are living in Japan. He's going to join us soon. He's just another call with a client. So between the three or four of us, we can hopefully answer any questions that you might have related to real estate in Japan. So feel free to raise your hand. We'll bring you up to the stage. The room is being recorded. I've also got the Japan Real Estate Podcast. You can find that on iTunes or Spotify or just Google Japan Real Estate Podcast. Always the ones that come up first, but we're only going to be addressing you by your first names or whatever name you've got on your Clubhouse profile, and this is only audio, so no one's going to see your picture. But if at any point you're not feeling comfortable with asking anything in public, or you're not feeling comfortable with anything being recorded, feel free to just click on our profile pic, and you can either contact us directly via Instagram or Twitter or LinkedIn or whatever we've got on our profiles, or just follow us to get new notifications when we turn up in any other rooms, or this one, which is every Wednesday again at 1:30.
So yeah, anyone's got a question or a topic that they'd like to discuss, feel free to raise your hand. That's the little icon at the bottom there for the new Android users, anyone's just joined this week. So that little raise hand button will bring you up to the stage and you can ask anything that you might want to. So yeah, we've got Asa, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Hey guys, thanks for your help. It's Asa here.
So Asa, thank you.
Appreciate it. Hi, so I'm a small business owner here in Osaka. I just got started about a year ago. I'm definitely interested in Japanese real estate. So I kind of have two questions. So I just wanted, one is more of an opinion question. I've heard a lot and I've read a lot with the population situation and I guess the real estate transfer of property being a bit confusing in Japan, that from everything I've read, there is going to be a surplus of vacant and or, you know, empty abandoned homes in Japan in the coming years. And the second question is, everything I've read, because of earthquakes and basically I've heard that, you know, buying Japan real estate is a bad investment simply because it's almost you're guaranteed to lose money on your investment. So I just kind of wanted some of your guys' thoughts on those two things.
Okay, well, on the I'll start and then I'll probably hand off, at least on the abandoned properties topic, I'll hand it off to Matt. But it's important to separate here the macro from the micro. So the macro population trend of Japan demographically is not good. And unless people start having more babies or the gates of immigration open a bit wider, that's probably going to remain the case for a good few years to come. But what that means in practice is that all of the smaller townships and villages and little mini cities, which are on the outskirts of the bigger metropolitan centers, are conglomerating into the cities themselves. So if you look at the population census, they've only released up to 2015 at this stage. They were supposed to release one last year, but because of COVID, it's only going to come out later this year. So you'll notice that the trend is that almost all major cities are actually growing in population. In one or two or three places, it's actually organic growth. There are people having babies. So places like Fukuoka, for example, Fukui City are growing organically. But as far as the other metropolitan centers are concerned, they're just absorbing all of the smaller townships around them. So that trend is probably going to continue for at least a few decades. And it's difficult to say what and if policies might change by then, but you're definitely looking at continued growth in almost all major cities, I think, except Sapporo maybe. The population is definitely growing and is going to continue to do that for years to come. And when you're talking about abandoned homes, and I'll hand the second part of that to Matt in a minute, but abandoned homes are usually referring to family homes. So as the families in Japan over the years become more granular, and this is happening anywhere in the world, but it's accentuated in Japan. So all of those bigger homes that used to house multi-generational families, maybe suburban, maybe older designs, older architectures, those are being abandoned or sold and demolished because people just don't need them anymore. So your typical Japanese professional couple or professional bread maker and one spouse who stays at home, they would at most have, on average, I think it's 1.4 children. I've never seen a 0.4 child, but in statistically, it's 1.4 children that these families have. So they've got absolutely no need for all of these old homes that they've inherited from their parents. And they actually prefer to be closer to a city center in a small apartment. The mansion, the condo units are really the asset class of choice for anybody who's buying a family home these days. So the abandoned homes that you're reading about are very different to the actual properties that are being sold and lived in and rented out all over Japan. So if you actually look at price trends, and that's, again, that's nowhere near a guarantee that that's going to continue. But if you look at price trends, at least up until COVID hit, so again, similar to the population trend, you'll see that prices in most of the major cities around Japan are actually rising. So while there's abundant supply of abandoned homes, and this is where I'll hand off to Matt, the actual properties that are constantly being purchased to live in are actually far more in demand than supply.
In fact, there's a bit of a shortage of supply, as Emil can probably testify to once he speaks about what's happening in Tokyo. But regarding abandoned homes, which are more located in suburban areas or countryside, I'll let Matt speak to that.
Yeah, sure. It was actually interesting. I was speaking with somebody earlier today regarding their property, and Ziv, you were talking about the kind of family element that goes into a decent percent. I wouldn't say anywhere near all abandoned homes have something to do with families, but certainly a decent percent does. And basically their issue was the real estate agents. Their father, I think it had been abandoned since 1990s or something like that. Really excellent spot, actually right near Itoshima, Ziv. In what was that place called? Can't remember at the moment.
Karatsu, right, maybe?
What was that?
Nishiku, Fukuoka City, or Karatsu? That's east and west of Itoshima.
A little bit more west of that.
Karatsu, probably.
Yeah, it was somewhere near there.
Yeah.
And a really nice spot. The you know, it needs some work and everything. But the issue that they were having is, so the sister, there's two sisters, and no, they're not fighting over it, which is kind of rare. The issue is that the real estate agents simply don't know what to do with it. And so it's sitting there for, I guess, about 30 years now, not particularly well taken care of, this one, so far as I can tell. The documentation is there. I'm currently waiting on receiving that just to see, well, not just to see, but to see exactly kind of the quality of the build and kind of everything about it. But it's, so yeah, it's not always the case that there's some kind of fight. And if sometimes anyway, the family has everything totally together, and it's merely the agents just don't know how to sell a property like that. Right.
But I guess often it's just a case of really the descendants don't really want the property, right? Like Emil was telling us, and we'll let him introduce himself in a second, but Emil was telling us last week that they've got a similar case in their family now. They've got a property that relatives are actually trying to offload and nobody wants it.
Well, it's yes, that's it, but it's a little bit more nuanced than that, in that the family in question doesn't want it. They want to reasonably get rid of it because they simply can't use it. They don't have any use for it. They want to off it, but the method in which, or rather the methods that they are presented with, at least kind of generally speaking, typically, are not the methods that are able to accomplish what they're trying to do, which is sell the property, which is, you know, not like a, I mean, it's a rural abandoned place, like, typical real estate agents don't do that normally, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of there's, you know, there's quite a bit of stock out there. It's merely that, well, maybe not merely, but part of the equation is that the standard model and the standard real estate in general, right, is done in one manner, which does not really jibe with what you're dealing when you're talking about Akiya and stuff. That's not to say, and I've said this before, that, you know, all Akiya are actually immaculate, you know, hidden gems. Like, most of them are complete garbage, right? So being able to locate the good ones is sort of the first step, but then this is also an aspect that needs consideration, which is how to sell them, which is not, the answer to that question is not in the same way that you would sell a more typical property.
Yeah, definitely. And probably not to the same types of buyers, too. Sorry, Tracy, you were going to say something?
I was going to say, I mean, back to Ace's question as well, saying that, you know, that there's not a lot of capital gain within buying, you know, buying abandoned properties. I think the main thing is that I think the building standards from the beginning were not that great. The buildings, you know, the buildings are not really built to last 150, 200 years like in other countries. A lot of these standard family homes are they're meant to come down and be rebuilt when you know, when a family member gets married, or for example. So they're not made from great standards to begin with. So what's valuable is the land. It's not necessarily the building that's on top of it. So, and that took me a long, when I first moved to Japan, I grew up in Australia where, you know, bricks and mortar, everything, you know, appreciated, and that's how you made, that's how you built wealth with the equity. It's just a different mindset. And when I, you know, I pushed back on that a little bit because it was against everything that I knew. But when I accepted that, it just sort of made a lot more sense. If you expect a property to appreciate, it just won't. But that said, if you accept the way things are here, then there's opportunities that you can find. Like, for example, within cash flow, like, you know, making it a short-term rental or making it a longer-term rental, or, you know, there's when you start to think of it differently, then that's when the opportunities rise.
Yeah, and I think that was what I was going to say to the second part of your question, Asa, that Japan is definitely not the place to go for property investment in the sense that many of the people in Western countries think about it, which is property always grows in value. I would actually argue that since 2008, at least, that's definitely not a given in other countries as well, but it's definitely not a given in Japan. So the sort of speculative purchases that you see in other countries where you purchase in areas that are bound for growth and where your property price will definitely grow, this is not the reason that people purchase here. But having said that, there's a reason that it's the second biggest property market in the world, including for investment, and that is because the things that attract people to invest in Japanese real estate are quite different to what it is in the West. So the main attractions are how affordable properties are, and that's because we're coming in on the back of two decades of deflation. So Tokyo and Osaka are pretty close to where they were pre-deflation, but all over the rest of the country, prices are extremely low, and rents, while they have dropped since 1990 something, they haven't dropped nearly to the extent that the prices have. So that gap means that people can actually get very good cash flow here compared to what they'd get in other parts of the developed world. And they can definitely get very good cash flow in comparison with how hassle-free the nature of the investment is. So in other countries, for example, if you invest in cheap properties and high rental returns on paper, you're basically investing in ghettos, you get problem tenants, you have to force evict people, you have to constantly chase rents. That sort of thing doesn't really happen in Japan. So even a cheaper property where the tenant's going to be a low income earner or somebody on a government welfare check just means that it's a cheaper, smaller, older property. That's about it. I mean, you don't get any of the headaches that you get with other properties. So it's a very hassle-free, headache-free sort of professional management environment. And the other thing is that the companies that you deal with, the stability and reliability of the property professionals and the building management companies, the insurance companies, the even the tax authorities, they are a lot easier to deal with and manage here. Once you get past the language and cultural gap, there's just, I don't know how to put this, you know, politely, but there's just not so many people reaching in your pocket and trying to get as much as they can out of the landlord as they would be in other countries. And I've experienced that when I've invested in the States and even in more, you know, legal recourse and more documented sort of countries like Australia and the UK, that's still an issue in many cases. And that just doesn't happen here. It's not to say that all the professionals you deal with are super professionals. You sometimes have to prod them and push them and just make them do their job, but they're definitely all as honest as they come, and you don't need to worry about whether the property is being handled properly, whether your money is being handled properly. And those are really the factors that attract people to invest here. That and the high cash flow and the stable sort of rental return. But before we carry on, I'll let Emil quickly introduce himself now that he's with us.
Hey guys. Yes, I was late. I was on another call. My name's Emil. I'm a real estate agent here in Tokyo. So I'm just a traditional real estate agent. We do home purchases for generally for families, but people that want to live in Tokyo long term, that are looking to buy their property, to buy their own personal family home. That's what I do. We're a largely Japanese agency, so most of our clients are Japanese, but I work with foreigners, so we provide all the information in English. And I can support you in English. And also the other big thing that we do, and look, most agents do it, but we do it as well, is arrange the financing. So we act as a mortgage broker, essentially. In Japan, they don't really have these mortgage brokers. Interest rates are so low, the banks cannot afford to pay off a commission or a trail, interest trail to the broker. But we provide that service because we need to close the deal. We get the sale commission from you, from the customer. So we also provide the mortgage brokering service and arrange the mortgage and financing for you. We have relationships with the mega banks, Mitsubishi UFJ, Mizuho, Rizona, and SMBC, and also some other ones like, you know, Shinsei and Prestia, of course. So any questions you have about buying your own family home or financing, how much you can borrow based on your, you know, relationship status, if your spouse is Japanese or if you have permanent residency or not, any of that sort of stuff, feel free to ask and I can happily answer that for you. Thanks.
Tracy, were you going to say something? Or?
Yeah, I was just going to tack on to something to the conversation with Asa that we were having, in that having a lot of these abandoned or empty or very low-cost properties outside of the metropolitan areas is actually a really good lifestyle opportunity for us city mice.
Especially now, right?
And I've actually just seen one of my friends in the audience. She's done exactly this. There are people who it's affordable to get a second house. It's affordable to have another property in an area that's much quieter than the city, where you can go out and get some green space or get some beach space. And I've had a couple of friends just even in the last 12 months buy places cash because they are so cheap. And that's more of a lifestyle investment rather than a investment in for capital gain. And I think as our society moves forward, I think, you know, that type of investment is going to be priceless on our productivity, on our mental health, and on, just on our lifestyle. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that moving forward, people having a city house and a country house and using them for themselves. There's big opportunities for that.
Yeah, and we're seeing a number of our clients opt into that kind of lifestyle, which is to say, you know, call it 80% or so of the purchases made with the intent of moving out and occupying and living in the property that they purchased. But then on top of that, going sort of the Minshuku route and offering teleworking comes up frequently, outdoor sports such as mountain climbing or hiking, wellness retreats, yoga, things like that. Also come up, and they're spinning up businesses. They're starting companies that are based out of their newly purchased place in which they also live, making things happen that way.
Yeah.
Shitty guys, lots of really good information. Thanks again.
No worries. And we had this conversation last week, and we're probably going to have it again, but for investment purposes, Japan is a cash flow environment, and the cash flow here is quite high. So we can elaborate more on that later. But let's move on to Ashley. Ashley, welcome to the state. Are you the same Ashley I've just communicated with on LinkedIn this week?
Yeah. You can't escape me, mate.
Oh, dear.
I'm stalking you.
Go for it, mate. Did you have a question?
Hey, this is Ashley in Tokyo. It was really a follow-up from the previous points, but you guys have basically beaten me to all of the key points. You know, with property in Japan, you shouldn't look at it from a capital appreciation as we would do in the UK or the US, but cash flow can be significantly improved. Just for example, here in Tokyo where I live, I was renting for 300,000 for 70 square meters. I then bought 200 yards down the road for 70 square meters, and now mortgage plus tax plus maintenance is 200,000, so cash flow saving of 100,000 a month, which is quite important. I think the other thing here in Japan is the mortgage rates, which was touched on by Emil and Tracy, but also the banks basically are awash with cash because the government keeps printing it and they don't know what to do with it. So as long as you have the patience to fill in the mortgage form and put your hanko in correctly several times, then actually it's really good. And then the other key point that I noticed that perhaps is pertinent here in Asia is, as best I understand, the real estate laws, property ownership laws, are race blind, in that if you try to buy something in China or Korea or Singapore even these days, it's quite hard if you're not
foreigner blind. I'd say depends on your residency more than your race. Yeah, even in Australia and New Zealand for that matter.
Yeah, So that's another really nice thing about the market here. Yeah, but if you're thinking of buying and then flipping it in 6 months' time with, I don't know, double profits, then wrong place. However, there are other benefits to it.
Yeah.
That was all my points. I think you guys have covered everything else.
No, spot on, spot on. And I also, that's a very important point that we forgot to mention. Japan's actually the only country in all of Asia Pacific, I think, that doesn't have any limitations on foreign buyers. You're actually exempt from some of the local taxes if you're not a resident. So it's very unique in that respect as well. So
yeah, I think they could just put a law out that you need approval if you're going to buy something that's close to whatever they deem to be a security threat. That's the only thing that's just come out recently, but otherwise, yeah.
I was not aware of that. Is that only for foreigners or for Japanese as well?
Best I understand for foreigners, and I assume it's something to do with the Senkaku Islands and buying next to nuclear reactors or Air Force bases, seems to be. Yeah, that's just been pushing through.
That's really interesting. I wasn't aware of that. Thank you.
Yeah. That's it. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something to that. One caveat. Yes, the banks are awash with money, but when you're self-employed, like I am, it is a lot harder. I don't qualify for all these like super cheap mortgages, unfortunately, so I have to go the investment rate. It's still cheaper than the interest rates from banks overseas, but banks love it if you work for a nice, big, stable company with a brand name. But when you're self-employed, you have a few more hoops to jump through. So,
my experience was I was working at the British Embassy at the time I applied for the mortgage, and they fell over backwards for me. It's like just the most wonderful thing ever. So, yeah, I can well imagine if you went as a self-employed person, they might have a different view.
Well, that's the also the downside of how we all of us who are self-employed are probably maximizing our tax benefits and making our incomes look as low as possible. So there could be a bit of that in there too.
I would never do that.
No, of course not. No. I mean, those are other people.
So I'm just going to jump on there. Look, it's when I talk to people, often we have like a 1 hour phone call just to talk about their financial situation and the sort of property that they want to buy. There's always, or almost always, for anyone who's not squeaky clean, so they just changed jobs or they've been transitioned and they were unemployed for more than 2 or 3 months. If they are self-employed or they're the company owner, they own their own KK and pay themselves a salary, so they're Daikyo Koishi Mariyaku. It ends up being like almost a two-year strategy. It's like, okay, this is the information you need to know. This is what the numbers need to look like and how much income you need and how your business needs to be functioning, etc., in order to qualify for the loan the kind of money that you need. And it's a two-year strategy. Just before this, actually, I was on the call to someone and he didn't have permanent residency. And he's single, and the fact that he needs a 20% deposit for the most part, because he just changed job, he needs a 20% deposit, means he needs about 10 to 15 million yen of cash. And I said, well, you either need to save that much or you need to apply for permanent residency, and that will happen if you apply now, you can get it in a year. So he's going to do that instead. And so it's a one-year plan before he can even start looking. But yeah, you need to start having the conversation and understanding realistically about where you stand now and where you need to be in order to qualify for the loan that you want. And that's why I tell people, that's why I think a room like this is so helpful. People that come onto this, and if you're one of those people in the audience, you've just come on, a lot of times you don't need to be ready to buy right now to talk and ask questions. But it's this engagement and asking questions that puts you in the right position so you can strategize and in 2 years' time, so you can plan, so in 1 to 2 years' time, be ready to go ahead and purchase. If you wait and say, oh, I'm not going to have my PR or I'm not going to, I won't be ready until 2 years' time. And then in 2 years' time, you found out, oh, no, you didn't plan correctly. So it's another 2 years from there. That's a disservice to yourself and your family. So get onto it sooner rather than later. And so even if you feel you're not ready now, at least get the right information so you can prepare effectively.
That's let me just back that statement up, as in support that statement and second that statement. It's it seems very basic, but at the same time, the number of times that, you know, people kind of just run into things and think, and, you know, a large purchase, right? It's like, geez, you don't know anything about this, and then it never happens. So yeah, do your research, prepare yourself for things, get yourself ready for, you know, the journey of all of this. And if you do that, then yeah, in a year's time, maybe it's 6 months time, whatever, but then it can happen. But if you wait, you know, it's just, it'll never come to fruition.
It's probably not a bad idea to also, especially for the self-employed among us, to also work with a good accountant in this sort of financial planning when you're looking ahead, because they will often know a lot more about what the banks are looking for, and they'll also know how to make your profit and loss statements be more appealing to the bank when they're reviewing those sort of documents in preparation. Before we move on to Insurrect, there just a quick reset of the room. So this is the Japan Real Estate Room. Welcome everyone who's just joined us recently. We're here once a week, 1:30 every Wednesday, Japan Standard Time, and we talk all things related to Japan real estate, answer people's questions, and we sometimes have a bit of a banter between us as well. And I'm Ziv. I'm a buyer's advocate and portfolio manager for foreigners who are residing in or out of Japan, mainly for property investments, also for holiday homes anywhere in the country. Matt to my right is the Akiya and abandoned homes guru. So he knows everything there is to know about purchasing abandoned homes or properties that seem like they're abandoned in the Japanese countryside, where there are plenty of bargains to be had, but also, as he likes to put it, plenty of garbage to be had. And Tracy, and to my far right, is the Minpaku Queen, and she is the master of everything related to short-term stays, whether you're purchasing properties or have properties that you want to use for the purpose of having guests in there on a short-term basis, so you can maximize your income via Airbnb or any of the other platforms that are out there for that, or whether you've got a home in Japan that you're not using all the time and you'd like to utilize it to make some extra money off it when you're not using it, and she's your queen there. And Emil at the middle of the bottom row there is a Tokyo real estate agent and broker who helps mainly expats and their families purchase family homes and apply for mortgages and find the right place for them in and around Tokyo. So moving on to Insurrect. Welcome, mate. Do you have any questions?
Thank you for having me on stage. This is the exact kind of information that I would like to have. I'm interested in maybe buying an abandoned home or, you know, cheaper real estate, but I don't have a PR. I'm a Thai citizen, and also, so I don't have permanent residency in Japan, and also getting, you know, for Thai citizens, we can only stay in Japan like 15 days at a time. I would like to ask if it is possible to buy property in Japan, like, you know, like this cheap abandoned home, and would that also in the future somehow can lead me to permanent residency in Japan, and what are the steps involved, and is that worth it at all to pursue this route? I'm sure you have been asked many times this question. But
I'll just say before Matt answers that I miss your country so much. I haven't been to Thailand in 2 years, and it's the first time in 20 years, and I'm homesick even though I don't live there. Sorry, Matt, go ahead.
Me too. We go to Thailand once a year, and it's just, we can't go. It's so sad.
Yes, and missing traveling also, and also missing Japan. I used to live there for a few years, so yeah, it's kind of like my second home too.
Yeah, to answer your question briefly, totally possible. Finance-wise, that's going to be kind of hairy a little bit. I'd say that you'd probably want to aim for a cash purchase. If you are coming in and out of the country, not having PR isn't necessarily a deal breaker, but it definitely helps to have that. But even if you don't, there are, you know, ways to go about it.
But they want Japanese income, right? They want to see you have income generated in Japan.
Yeah. There's always been, you know, marriage certificates and things like that, so you can kind of stack the deck in your favor, even if you don't have that. Let's see. I'm fading right now because it's 1 a.m. over here. What was the second part of that question?
Well, when you take cash purchases, what?
PR and it's worth it.
Yeah, in a sense. I would say that the easiest and easiest of the options, but not necessarily easy, would be to start a what amounts to a holding company in your name that manages the property that you've purchased. It sounds kind of strange, but this is one way towards self-sponsorship. And by doing that, you can continually renew your visa up until the point that you can gain PR. That being said, if you get a job offer over here too, and what is it, 10 years at this point that you need?
It's dropped to 5 now, I think.
It's 5 now?
With certain conditions, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, really, there's any number of ways to go about getting PR as well. So long as you get it, that'll only, stack the deck further in your favor.
There's easier ways to get a PR. We went through this process with quite a few clients who are interested, and it's a lot easier to get a PR by just setting up a small shop and, starting
a
company
to
do that rather than invest in real estate and generate the sort of income that'll justify a PR.
I'm going to just jump in and say Paisan, I think it says your name is. I'm going to say it's probably a bit different. Unless you have lots of cash to, a significant cash to purchase a property, I think to have a business investor visa, because essentially you're going to come with a business investor visa in order to set up your company and sponsor yourself, right? The company needs to have at least, I think, 5 million yen worth of capital, paid in capital, and there are some other conditions. So
setting up the company, it'll end up costing you between 7 and 8 million. At least the 5 million paid in capital on top of this company establishment fees and everything else that goes along with it.
Yeah. So what I suggest is, rather than thinking, I know sort of in Australia, for example, I don't know if they still do it, but they did before. If you just put in, a few $100,000 in purchase of property for that, you could technically have, it's like you invested in the country. So that was sufficient. Whereas in Japan, it's a little bit different. What you should be searching for is how to get residency using a business investor visa and all the requirements on how to establish a company. The fact that the company manages a real estate property or, as Ziv mentioned, maybe has a shop is kind of irrelevant. And depending on your financial situation, it could just be a bit it's quite prohibitive. You need to have quite a bit of cash behind you to be able to come here and establish a company that's not really doing a lot of real active business. You don't have an existing business that it's going to operate. It's really going to be something from scratch. And to have a business substantial enough that you can renew a visa for a decade until you get permanent residency, that could be a bit complex. So that's what you should research, is getting permanent, how to get a business investor visa and what the requirements are for establishing a company. I feel that could be the biggest hurdle. If you can clear that, great. But don't think just purchasing an Akiya is going to be the easy approach. It's not that easy.
It'll be a lot easier, for example, to set up, I'm just thinking, you're saying Thailand, so to set up Thai food or a Thai massage or something related to Thai products anywhere in Japan, I think you need to invest just 5 million yen, so 50,000 US roughly. And that will actually be a business that generates more income than a passive income stream from a property will be. That'll probably be a much easier way to get a visa in the long term, I think.
So what I gather is, please correct me if I understand correctly. In order to gain a PR, you need to prove a certain level of income being generated in Japan. Is that correct?
That's to renew it every year. So to set it up, you need a business plan, and you probably need to hire one or two local staff, depending on how much you're planning to invest. And I'm happy to put you in touch with an immigration lawyer that our customers often work with, who can provide more accurate details. But the real challenge, after you've submitted the business plan and it's been approved, that's going to get you a visa for 1 year. The challenge is to prove that you're actually generating taxable income every year that would suffice for you to keep extending that visa. And that needs to be taxable income, so pre-tax net income of 2.5 million roughly
per dependent. So if it's just you, it's 2.5. If you got a wife and two kids, it then becomes 10.25 million and so forth.
So definitely just owning a property in Japan doesn't entitle you to PR.
Well, it will if it's a property that you've purchased for, say, $1 million, $1 million US, and it's generating that sort of, you know, income every year. But like we were saying, there are much easier, cheaper ways to generate that income.
I'm going to just answer that and say probably no.
Yeah.
Okay.
My general take is if you're, it's just not the approach that you would take. But what I do recommend is jump on, there's a site called Tospec, T-O-S-B-E-C, the Tokyo One-Stop Business Establishment Center, and they give lots of advice for, basically it's in English, on how to establish a company and come in as a business investor with a business investor visa. And so you can ask them, look, what, like, so it's Tospec, T-O-S-B-E-C, so just Google them. And reach out and do an online consultation with them, and they can explain getting a visa through business establishment and as a business investor, and that I think is the approach. What your business does, whether it's property management, etc., is it doesn't really matter. But what your question, which I think you're asking, is just by owning an asset, owning a property in Japan, does that entitle you to some kind of visa or residency status? And the answer is no, that doesn't.
The best way to do it via property purchase, I would say, if you are interested in that sort of thing, is to buy one of those countryside homes and turn it into a guest house. It's actually a business that's generating income every year. And then if that income is sufficient, then that might be a sort of hybrid way of using the property to get a business visa. But it's still, it's just a normal business visa, regardless of which business you're actually running.
Just one last question. Do you have to be present in Japan at a minimum like length each year in order to gain PR during all these visa processes?
10 years.
How many years in a year?
Generally speaking, for the business visa to be renewed every year, they would want to see that you're here for at least half the year out of every year that you're asking to renew it. And so in the year leading to that renewal. And from the immigration lawyer's experience, the one that we've been normally talking to, they, at least in the first year, it's highly recommended that you stay here for most of the year and show them that you're actually working on the business.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in there and say, if you're only coming in for 15 days at a time, you're coming in as a short-term, on a short-term visa. Again, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an immigration lawyer, but if you're coming in and out via on short-term visas, then you're not actually supposed to be working, so that's actually not counted as residency.
Now, I think he means after he's gotten the visa, if he actually still needs to stay in the country for it to be renewed.
I see. Sorry. My mistake.
Yes, thank you. All of this information is very helpful. Thank you very much. And I hope to see you all in Thailand very soon.
Yes, but again, look, we're not immigration lawyers. Please consult a professional. There's some good ones around. Ziv can introduce you. I can introduce you.
Yeah, the one that we work with will only charge you, I think, 5,000 yen, so $50 for a one-hour consultation, and he's got all the answers. So it's a really good investment if that's the route you're planning to pursue.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
No worries. And if anybody else has got any questions, please feel free to raise your hand. We'll bring you up to the stage. We're happy to talk about all and anything related to Japan real estate, and as you can see, a bit of other topics as well. So don't be shy. Raise your hand. Come up to the stage. And
hey, I'm gonna jump off.
Go to sleep, Matt.
Yeah, that's what I want to do.
Where are you, Matt? Where are you?
I'm in Michigan right now.
Are you on a visa? Are you on a vaccine run? Are you?
I sure am. Got here five days ago, and I've got 20 more to go.
So many people are on vaccine runs right now.
Yeah, I'm a bit jealous, actually.
Yeah. Well, hey, if you want details, I'd be happy to fill you in.
I don't think any of us qualify for it. Yeah.
Well, that's true. Yeah. But I can give you, you know, the general rundown, I guess. I'm tired. I'm not speaking.
Guam are talking about opening up for visa tourism. So, because they're doing the Johnson & Johnson one shot. So, they're completely vaccinated their whole population.
Vaccine tourism. Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah. So, Guam, Saipan, it's like 2 hours. Like, you could do a 2 hour. Like, go for a weekend, get your shot, go to the beach, come home. So.
And then 2 weeks quarantine on your way back in, right?
You will have to quarantine on your way back in, yes. Yeah.
Can I just say, how pathetic is Japan at rolling this out when it's more practical to travel overseas to get it done? But that's my life. I'm leaving.
It's insane. It's absolutely insane.
And so most, if you're well connected, if you're high up, then you will have already gone to the US and got your shot. So. It's such a divide between, you know, the connected and the great unwashed like we are.
And the plebes, right?
Yeah, the plebes, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
All right, well.
Get out of here, Matt.
Well, hey, all y'all have a good good talk and see you next week.
Have a good night, Matt.
Bye, Matt.
Yeah.
So I just want to encourage anyone who's got questions to come up. Otherwise, we'll just vamp up here because I was going to ask Ziv a couple of questions about his podcast. So you're streaming this live onto your podcast, and that is that YouTube or what? Which platform's that on? And what are the main questions that people connect to you about your business through the podcast?
Oh, okay. Well, first, we're not streaming it live. I'm recording it very old school, like on my PC with a microphone. I got a really good microphone that one of our customers who loves the podcast bought for me because he was tired of hearing me garbled. So I've got a pretty good microphone, which helps. And I'm recording this on my PC. And then I just save these. And the ones that are really interesting and have got a lot of topics that people are often asking about, then I publish as podcast episodes. And the podcast we have is hosted on a platform called Podigy, which is a pretty cheap one. And it also helps us to then, they automatically push the podcast out to the iTunes store and Spotify and Stitcher and all the places where podcasts are usually searched for and found. So it's just really convenient for us. And then we also feature them on our website and we put links to them on social media channels and so forth. As for the questions that people ask, it really depends on who's asking and where they heard about us. So people who heard about us in an investment context have got a lot of investment-related questions. People who are just looking for holiday homes obviously have different types of questions. So it depends. It also depends on whether they're familiar with Japan or not, because we often... Hey, Jamie. Because we often get... We often get approached by people who have actually lived in Japan or have traveled to Japan extensively, and then they don't have any questions about Japan. They just want to also get their foot into real estate here. On the other hand, we often get contacted by investors who are just looking for a really good deal, and they know absolutely nothing about Japan. So for them, it's yet another Asian country, and they want to see how they can benefit from investing here. So it really wide gamut of questions depending on who the person is.
Interesting. Yeah, thanks for that. It just seems like there's just so many great podcasts out there. I just don't have enough hours in the day to listen to them all. So I'll put you on my list, Steve.
Tell me about it. That's okay. I've tried listening to everything I'm interested in and figured out that I'm years behind on catching up on episodes when I do that. So I've only got like 3 or 4 that I actually listen to these days, because it's only really like while exercising or cooking or during commute, right? Like that's the only time that I can actually focus on listening to a podcast. I can't focus and write at the same time. It just doesn't work for me. Jamie, moving on to you, mate. Any questions?
You'll have to unmute there, Jamie.
The little microphone icon, mate.
Little microphone icon so that we can hear you. There you
go. Sorry for the background noise. I'm on the street at the moment. I was curious to know how price negotiations went for all of you who have purchased properties in the countryside and so on, and how Japanese sellers are.
How what works? Sorry, I missed the first. Missed the first part of your question there. Sorry, Jamie. How does what work?
How do price negotiations tend to go when you've you know, decided on a property you're interested in, and you make an offer, you know, it's customary in other countries, you know, to offer what you think the property's value is and or its income potential and so on. And just curious.
Yeah, well, I think Emil might have something to say about family homes in that regard, but on the other hand, he mainly deals with new homes, so I'm not sure what he's got on secondhand homes. As far as investment properties are concerned, those are normally priced based on the rental yield that they generate. So the investor obviously knows what sort of yield the property generates, and he, together with his selling agent, will price it based on that. And then we, depending on how popular the area is and how attractive the property is, we might be able to take it down by 10 or 15%. And that's generally acceptable. But if it's in a really highly desired location or it's a highly desired property profile, then the seller will often just say no because they know that they're going to get attractive offers coming in. If you're talking about homes in the countryside or vacant homes or abandoned homes, then it's probably a lot more doable, mainly because people are often looking to get rid of it just so they can stop paying the property tax. So in those cases, you could potentially bring them down more. But really, really lowball offers like you sometimes get in Western countries are considered a little bit rude here. So if you would come in offering 50% of the asking price, often that seller will just not want to speak to you again because they consider it to be a ridiculous offer.
Okay, that's very helpful. So it's pretty much just a reasonable negotiation, just like anywhere else.
Well, I'll...
And demand and, okay, sorry, go ahead.
Jamie, so let me... So my experience is I work sort of mostly in family homes in Tokyo, and that's... So they're not abandoned or anything like that. They may need a renovation. So whether it's new or used, budgets list took something, say, anywhere between 40 million to 150 million yen, right? So between, say, 400,000 US to $1.5 million US. If you want to talk about properties like this, you know, let's say midway, say 70 million yen, you can maybe negotiate if it's a brand new property, okay, like a brand new house, or maybe say two off the bat, about 2 million yen. It depends if it's still under construction or if it's actually complete. Generally, when it's in the construction stage, the seller is not in a hurry to really sign the contract, right? Because even if they sign the contract of sale, the person's not going to move in until, you know, 3 to 6 months later is not the settlement, right? So they'll just rather keep it on the market and try to get the full price for it. After it's built and it's not sold for about 3 months, it may take, then they may drop it 2 or 3 million yen. So again, this is working on, say, a 70 to 80 million yen property. You might have about 2 or 3 million yen of negotiation in there. And after it still doesn't sell for, like, you know, almost 6 months, you might have 4 to 5 million yen worth of further discount. But it does take time. They're not going to discount it right away. Probably right off the bat, maybe 1 to 2 million yen is the most you can sort of realistically negotiate.
How about secondhand homes, Emil? Do you have much experience with those?
So I'm just about to go into that. So that's with a brand new property. Now, with secondhand properties, so with a brand new house, or imagine with a developer, they kind of price it accurately. And depends on how quick they want to sell it, they can think, oh, we'll price it a little bit higher. And someone where this house really checks all of their boxes is going to be willing to pay the premium for it. Okay, and that's kind of their strategy. Sometimes they price it, they know, just right at market, like it's a good value, and they get all sold before they're even built. Okay, it depends on the developer. Generally, the larger developers can price a bit higher because they have more funds and can hold out waiting to get the you know, they have more financing available, and they're not in as much of a rush. Now, with used homes, the situation is completely different. And it depends on the urgency of the seller. Generally, the owner is still living there. And if their next property that they want to move to, if they've already bought it and built it, generally what happens is maybe they've outgrown it, they've had more kids, and they're just
you know, the kids are a bit bigger and they've outgrown the property, they need to move. If they've already bought the next place, right, they'll say, okay, like, just say they're building the new house and it's going to be built in, you know, be ready in 4 months' time. They won't accept a really lowball offer, right, because they still have 4 months before they need to move out. But what happens is as it gets closer to the date, they might be a bit more flexible on price, 2 or 3 million yen. And then if they've actually already moved out and it's vacant and it's already been 3 or 4 months of vacancy, we can even get maybe 10% negotiation room. If they, and that's only though if they've generally started it with a high price. Remember, we're talking sort of in Tokyo, like the 23 wards. So maybe their pricing, they started a bit high, they love the property and it was just not realistic. Generally, properties are on the market for about 3 months. If it gets sold within 3 months, then that's average and means it was priced pretty okay, pretty reasonably. 6 months means it was priced a bit high and is taking a bit of time. There's something wrong with the property. It's not so attractive. It's not priced accordingly. So you could have a bit more negotiation room. Depends on the urgency of the seller. Some situations, probably the least attractive situation and least negotiation room as a buyer is when the owner is just, their next place they're going to go to is they're going to rent. So whenever they sell their current property, they're just going to move their family and start renting the next place. And sometimes it will actually say, look, we, from when the contract is signed, they want, the seller wants 2 months of lead time so they can find their next rental property. And because they're just renting, they're in no rush. They just, whenever's ready. And so that has the least room for negotiation, maybe say 1 to 2 million yen at that. And it, you know, a lowball offer is just not going to be accepted. But yeah, anywhere from say 1 to 5 million yen is what I would say is realistic. If someone, if one of our clients comes in and says, hey, we want to do, instead of 70 million, we want to offer 60. I won't even present that to the buyers, the agent. I'll tell the client, look, no, it ruins our reputation. If we start going with those kind of offers to sellers, they'll say, you know, Emil, why are you wasting our time? Right? This client is not serious. You know, this property is worth a lot more. And in the future, when we try to negotiate, they're not going to take us seriously as an agent. So we need to maintain our relationship with the seller's agent as well. So we can't go with just unreasonably lowball offers.
That was fascinating, Emil. I stand educated. As I can say that we're definitely a lot more aggressive in the investment sector.
Yeah, I think when people are trying to sell investment properties, their strategy, it's more financial. There's different reasons for it. When it's your own personal home, I think the factors are different.
Does that work the other way as well? Because, you know, haggling's not part of the culture necessarily in Japan. When you're selling, does it... you know, does that work in your favor if you do try to bump the price up a little bit high, being a bit cheeky, or does it just mean that you're going to languish on the shelf?
So it's pretty common for people to aim a bit high and give themselves a buffer to, like, you know, put it 2 or 3 million yen higher, because people, even just in the Japanese market, they, if it's priced at 68 million, even though, like, the seller will actually say, look, we're comfortable with, or the agent will discuss, so look, this is how much you can expect, about 65. We'll price it at 67, right? And we'll see what interest we get. And, you know, but at least we know we can get 65. And I even have agents, when I go do viewings, the agents will tell me, look, you know, it's been on the market for 1 or 2 months. So look, they'll actually accept about 65 or 64, right? So if you can get your client up to that, then we can get our client down a bit. They'll let me know sometimes, but it's generally within that kind of range, right? Just like, you know, so on, if it's a 40 million yen property, there's not going to have 3 million yen worth of negotiation room so much. But if it's a, like, usually the houses I deal with, like, are over 60, 70 million, yeah, you know, 2 to 3 million yen is kind of actually a pretty decent negotiation. We did one where we got about six million yen off. That was in March of last year, which was right at the start of the state of emergency, so no one had any idea what was going on. And that was a 120 million yen property. We got it for 114. Sorry, so 6 million yen off. So just to give you kind of the idea of realistic kind of negotiation prices.
One of the things, Tracy, too, with investment properties as opposed to family homes is that no one's going to get emotionally attached to an investment property, right? Like nobody looks at a... like a one-bedroom, one-hour studio unit in some building that was built in 1995 and think, oh, my God, that's my dream home. So the people who sell them really have to put them on the market at prices that are going to attract other investors. Otherwise, no one's going to even give them the time of day. So they're priced, I think, quite accurately on the investment front. And if not, they'll be discounted fairly quickly.
It's interesting that I'm hearing you guys talk about the Japan real estate market, and the behavior is very similar to the U.S. I sell properties in the U.S., and everything you guys say, it repeats itself in the U.S. Like, if you have a property for $500,000, you're not going to get it for $400,000. You're going to probably drop it down to $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 at the most. And everything else behaves exactly the same.
Humans are humans, right?
One thing is different, I'm going to say, Andrew. We never sell or offer above the asking price.
Yeah. Correct, same here. Yeah, same here.
No, in Australia, there's rarely a fixed price. It's almost always auctions, or they give a price guide, and they will get multiple offers, and that will sort of
go. Oh, the auction style, that doesn't happen.
And similar with rental. Whereas if I want to purchase, just say the property is 60 million yen, and my client gets the financing approved and is the first with the offer for 60 million yen, the agent will accept it, then the seller will, okay, we've accepted you. They will not contact the other potential buyers and say, we got an offer for 60, can you give 62 million?
Yeah, that never happens here.
That does not happen.
But Emil, before we jump off to you, we had Saad on the stage. I think he also wanted to ask a question.
Perfect. Yeah, thank you very much, Ziv, Emil, and Tracy. I think my question, being someone sitting in the US and just very interested in Japan in general, having spent multiple times and all, I think I wanted to just understand as an investment asset, like what is the long-term view of investing in real estate in Japan? And the reason I ask is I think of it from a macroeconomic perspective, where you have, you have deflation, where you have, situations with the population growth. So I'm curious, how do you think of price appreciation or rental returns when it comes to investing in real estate in Japan, given that the economic conditions may not be, are very unique in Japan than in the rest of the world. And so I'd love to just hear what you think about that and what are the different pros in terms of looking at that type of asset if I'm looking to hold an investment property for 5 to 10 year time horizon. Thank you.
Yep. So on the investment front, that's spot on what you said. So Japan is a totally different environment economically and investment wise, and people invest here purely for cash flow. Okay, so it's not generally a growth environment. Properties in larger metropolitan centers do tend to hold their value, at least. And in some cases, if the economy overall does well, then those central locations will also rise in price. I mean, Tokyo and Osaka specifically, we mentioned before, are now close to where they were pre-1990s when the last bubble burst here. They've actually recovered almost to that point, at least before COVID hit. But other parts of the country are very, very affordable. And that's another one of the reasons that people actually purchase them. So while the population is declining overall, what it means for larger metropolitan centers is it's actually conglomerating or centralizing. So you've got all of these little towns in and around the bigger cities that are actually moving or being absorbed into the bigger metropolitan centers. So if you look at most of the cities, the bigger cities and the medium cities in Japan, they're actually gaining in population, not organically, but because they're absorbing these smaller townships. And that's probably going to be the case at least for the next couple of decades. And by that time, things might change demographically as well, depending on policy, immigration, birth rates, and so forth. But if you're looking at a 5 or 10 year period, the cash flow that you're going to get from these properties is probably going to be on par, in some cases better than the speculative growth that you might get in other countries. So that sort of evens out, and that's what draws people here. And the second and third things that draw them here is how affordable these properties are, at least out of Tokyo and Osaka. So for the same price that you would have bought a single family home in the USA, and definitely in places like Australia or Singapore or New Zealand, where a lot of our customers come from, you would have bought 5 or 6 or 7 properties here in Japan. So that gives you more diversity as far as your income stream goes, socioeconomic, geographical locations, and so forth. So one tenant moves out in your single property in the US, Australia, and New Zealand, that's your income stream down to zero. And here, for the same capital that you've deployed, one tenant moves out equals maybe 25% of your income stream. You're still generating income. So that's added hedging. And the third reason is, again, like we mentioned earlier, is it's just hassle-free, right? So the tenants are docile, the property professionals and the banks and the insurance companies, the people that you deal with on a regular basis, they're very reliable and honest. They don't have their hands in your pocket kind of thing. So it's a very headache-free, hassle-free environment to be operating in. So you can just focus on making the money rather than chasing rents and chasing professionals and so forth. I think, is that what you were asking?
Yeah, no, this is really helpful. And I think you've answered, you really gave me a really good perspective. And I was wondering in that along the same lines, would you say that investors look at primarily residential and not commercial? Or is it a mix and both of them are basically, are both of them interesting from a returns perspective or as interesting? Because the benefit of commercial is you get these longer term and maybe more reliable tenants and all. And if you don't have to worry about that because the Japanese tenant is just very good, well-behaved and pays on time and everything else like that, then maybe the benefits of going into a larger commercial isn't as warranted as it is in the US or elsewhere.
Well, again, there's a couple of factors that come into play here that are a bit counterintuitive to what you'd see in other countries. So the upside and downside, depending on when you bought and what sort of tenant you have, is for the same reason that the price is now low, rents are now a lot lower than they were in the 1990s, for example. But the Japanese don't tend to be, they tend to avoid confrontation at all costs. So you'll often have cases where you're purchasing a property that's already got a tenant in there, and that tenant's moved in, say, 15 years ago because they like to stay in the same place for as long as they can. They're still paying the rent that they've paid 15 years ago because they just don't want to come up to the landlord and try to negotiate a lower price, even though they're fully aware that had they moved across the street to a similar property or, you know, two suburbs down to a similar property, they might have been paying half the rent, but they're never going to confront the landlord and ask for a rent reduction. On the residential front. On the commercial front, on the other hand, it's more of the standard dynamics that you'd expect from other countries. So commercial rents can be raised when the economy does well. So if you've got a lease in place for, say, 5 years, at the end of those 5 years, if the economy does well, and obviously if your business does well and you're still there, then it's quite reasonable to expect that the landlord will ask for a higher rent, and then you know you'd make your own calculation as a business renter whether you want to pay that or not. But on the other hand, it's a lot more volatile. So our customers, for example, are interested in both, but as soon as COVID hit, the focus shifted, and I don't think it's only our customers. I've been reading that in reports from other bodies as well. The focus shifted far more towards residential properties because they're considered a lot more safe and stable, actually, in Japan than commercial properties are, and definitely so in times of crisis. And a large part of that is because Japan is a very sheltered working environment, so not as sheltered as it was up to a decade or two ago, but still it's very rare to see massive layoffs. It's very rare to see people taking salary hits or being out of a job in Japan. So you're not going to see people not being able to pay the rent in most cases. You're not going to see mass evictions, forced evictions or otherwise. It's the residential side of things is actually the more stable sector here compared to commercial. But commercial can gain more yield overall depending on where and how and what sort of properties you buy. So it really depends on the investor and the risk appetite. We try to advocate a diversity of both, but maybe depending on investor appetites, maybe 60 to 80% residential and the rest commercial, just to be able to get a bit more diversity in hedging.
Hey, Ziv, if you don't mind, could you expand on that and talk about the key money? Because as an actual renter who's leaving Tokyo at the end of the month to move to Chiba, it was the rent itself is 50% less, but to move into another apartment with the key money is exactly the same price I would be paying to move to another prefecture further out of Tokyo. I'm walking on the street.
Yeah. We will in a moment, Raymond, but let me just move down the line and we'll get to there in a second, okay?
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you very much, guys. I feel my questions have been very well answered, and I'm happy to pass it down to whoever's next.
No worries. And guys, just a quick, not really a room reset, but just a minute. If there's any topic, we're getting pretty long with the timing here. So if there's any topic that you want to talk about that we haven't been able to answer or get to yet, feel free to click on our profile pics. You can, of course, follow us so you'll get a notification of whenever this room comes up again. But also you can click on the links in our profile to message us directly via Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, whatever we've got there. We'll be happy to answer any and all of your questions. And our profile also usually state what it is that we are specializing in. So, Jason, how are you, mate?
I'm well. Listening in while sort of working. So thanks very much. Very interesting. I have a question about if you invest in the house here, whether it's a residential property at first or an investment property, and then you leave the country. How are people maintaining bank accounts, etc., when they're no longer a resident to maintain their property? My wife's been looking into that, and when you leave the country, you're supposed to let them know, of course, that you're no longer a resident. And you could use family addresses, and then you'd have to pay tax, residence tax, and things like that. Perhaps also other complications, but how do people handle owning property here and not being in the country?
I can't talk about the people earning property and having bank accounts. What will my clients do, actually? The clients that I look after their houses, and I put their money into their local bank accounts, and then they use that to pay the mortgage. But they often reside their residency is outside of Japan right now. I don't know what they've declared for their own personal taxation system, so that's kind of up to them. But I know that people do that because I do it for my clients. So whenever I pay them their rent, or whenever I pay them their commissions on short term rental income, I put it into a local bank account, and then they deal with it from there. But just as an anecdote as well, my parents lived in Japan 20 years ago, and they left, and they come back to Japan once a year. Normally, they come back to Japan once a year. They've still got their bank accounts. They've just got their home address labeled as my address, and they come in and out of the country and then use their own money when they're here, which just makes it easier. But they've never had any issues with taxes because they've already handed in their residency cards. They don't have a visa here anymore, but the banks, whether that's a no-no or not, I'm not sure, but there's never been a problem.
Now, mainly people just forget to mention it to the bank. They notify the immigration department when they leave, and they don't really remember to notify the banks that they've left, so they just hang on to their accounts. But Jason, in other cases, like all of our customers, I'd say
70 or 80% of our customers reside overseas and don't have bank accounts. So in that case, if they're only invested in a single location or a couple of single locations, then they work directly with the property manager who collects the funds, keeps it for them to either withdraw when they come here or to remit overseas to their overseas accounts. And those who are more diversified and have more portfolios in various locations usually use a portfolio manager like us who provides the same sort of service. We collect it from the property managers, we pay all of the expenses, and we give them an annual statement and then remit to their chosen account overseas whenever they instruct us to.
Can I also add to that in terms of the bank loan? JC, I think we've had similar discussions in the past. So in general, the home loans, when you get a, so I think your idea is, okay, you buy your own personal family home and you have a home loan, a mortgage, and then you were to leave the country. Okay, you're Australian, you move back to Australia. What do you do? Technically, the bank says, if it's no longer your primary residence, even if you are still living in the country, if it's no longer your primary residence, you need to notify the bank and pay off the loan. The other thing that, in terms of banks, is if you're not resident, you should not maintain an account, a bank account. What happens realistically is if it's your primary residence and for some reason you move out, the bank, you know, and you can change your address with the bank. Generally, the banks don't inquire about the property, what's happening to it. Or if they do, say, look, I've moved overseas for whatever, for work, for just a few years, I plan on returning. It's still my primary, it's still going to be my residence when I return. It just shouldn't remain vacant for that period. They won't change anything, or they won't request any changes to the loan as long as you're paying the mortgage on time. But then in terms of maintaining an account, if you have permanent residency, then I guess the idea is you could possibly return to the country at some time, so there's no harm in maintaining an account. And your residency card also has no expiry date. It says your length of residency is permanent, so you don't there's no expiry to it. Recently, was the last time I went into my Prestia bank, they actually asked me for a copy of my residency card to confirm the statements and to confirm the date, the length, and I've heard that for a few people as well. So if you have permanent residency, I think it's not so much an issue. If you are not a permanent resident, then I'm not certain what actually happens. But as you mentioned, so you know, don't necessarily mention it to the bank. And if the bank do find out later on, they may contact you and ask you to stop the account, etc. But yeah, I think the intention is that you may come back and live in the property at some time. Even if there is no schedule for it, then
you're overseas on the work, right?
Maintain.
Yeah,
because my wife was saying even she needs to tell the bank. So I am a PR, but
Yeah, that one doesn't have anything to do with the foreigner or non-foreigner. Basically, anyone who's no longer residing in Japan, whether Japanese or not, by bank policies are requested to notify the bank and close the account when they leave. But it's a bank policy, right? It's not a law, so you can definitely forget. But again, for managing properties in your absence, definitely people who are more foreigner oriented, like Tracy, I don't know that Emil does property manager, but property managers in Tokyo, Niseko, a few in Osaka, definitely near the army bases in Yokosuka, Okinawa, and so forth. There are property managers who are used to working with foreigners, so they will be able to collect and remit funds overseas, and you know, hold a retainer and pay your expenses out of that. And in other locations around the country, or if you've got more locations, then a portfolio manager is your best bet.
When you get a home loan, even if you leave the country, so when you have a home loan, just say it's with Mizuho Bank, you'll have that home loan gets paid through a Mizuho Bank account. Even if you've never used Mizuho Bank before, once you get the home loan, you have to create a Mizuho account, and that's where the home loan will get their money from, withdraw the money from the monthly payment or your mortgage repayments. So it's not really possible for you to close the accounts and maintain the loan. Okay, that makes no sense.
They're not going to be accepting mortgage payments from overseas, right?
Yeah, it doesn't happen.
If you didn't know that, and you beautifully told the bank, hey, I'm leaving the country, I'm not going to be a resident for some years, they're going to freak out. You've got a loan to do.
I think, to be honest, the bank will rather turn around and say, but you're going to come back to Japan, right? You're planning to come back and live in the property once you finish.
Yeah, they're not looking for the hassle either, Jason.
But at the same time, I'm going to say, look, if there are some people that are a bit more risk averse and, you know, maybe anxious about, you know, administrative items like this, and I'm going to say, yeah, if you feel you or your spouse are one of those people that you just work on, these are the technical requirements, and if we leave, we can't, you know, we have to notify and we have to close and we have to sell the property if we no longer live there, then perhaps owning is not the best option for you, because you're never going to have the peace of mind that you want.
All right. So, sorry, Jason.
I wonder if a lot of foreigners who invest in their home here actually make that.
Well, you don't need a bank account to invest in Japan, though. I mean, to own a property and, you know, pay the bills and get the income from rental, you don't need... I mean, it'll be easier if all of our customers could open a bank account, but the vast majority of them can't, so there are just solutions for that, right?
Oh, Ziv, no, I think he meant, like, people that purchase a home and then leave the country.
Yeah, but I mean, not everyone's going to then sell their home immediately, right? Like, people would still be doing something with it.
Yeah, presumably then it turns into a rental property.
Yeah, so I'm saying that even if you do end up closing the account, that's surmountable at least. I'm not sure about the mortgage, but it's definitely surmountable as far as renting it out and paying the bills go.
Interesting. Anyway, thank you, guys.
No worries. Alejandro, do you have? We heard from you before, but did you have any questions as well?
Yeah, sorry about interrupting before. Yeah. What can you get for, like, let's say about 25 million yen? Can you do the breakdown on what you can get in rent and where you get a property or things like that for investment purposes?
Yep. So I would say it really depends on your yield requirements and any other criteria that you might have. So if a customer would come to us and say that they want to maximize and get the best potential percentage rental yield for that amount, we would probably advise to them to separate it into two smaller, cheaper properties, or maybe even three, depending on where they buy. So we'd advise them to not purchase in central Tokyo or central Osaka. They would go for secondary cities, which can be quite big. Like Yokohama, for example, is Japan's second biggest city. But not Tokyo and Osaka in as far as they're considered the business and most internationally renowned centers of Japan. So we would direct them away from Tokyo and Osaka to places like Yokohama, Nagoya, Fukuoka, maybe Sapporo or Kyoto. So secondary cities or satellite cities, so the bedroom communities and the prefectural capitals that are either around the bigger metropolitan centers like Kobe near Osaka or Chiba City or Saitama near Tokyo. And then in those locations, you could potentially purchase two or three rental units, so condo units, which are usually the asset class of choice, at least for investment. And those would probably generate a return of somewhere between 5 to 8% net pre-tax. So including all of your purchase and non-running costs, but not including whatever your annual tax circumstances and not including any unknowns like vacancies or maintenance and so forth. So we can provide rough estimates on that, but depending on the size of the portfolio, those tend to be skewed. So net pre-tax, I'd say 5 to 8% annually. If you want something that's a bit more safe and stable, then maybe a single condo unit in Tokyo, Osaka, Fukuoka, maybe Nagoya. Those are, I would consider, the most safe and stable locations, Kobe, Yokohama as well, but maybe a single unit. In that case, you would get maybe 5 to 6%, if you're lucky, net before tax per annum. And if we're very lucky, especially now with COVID, we have seen a few smaller buildings in some of those secondary cities. So you could potentially get a 4 or 6 unit block for that price. It's not going to be super new and super central, but it could be a pretty good cash cow, and you'd have a larger land plot to go with it. And you'd have the creative freedom to do more things with the property itself than you would if you were to buy individual condo units, because those are subject to building management and owner union bylaws. Whereas if you own the entire structure, you're more free, depending on municipal limitations, but you're more free to lease it out short term. In the future, you might want to tear it down, build something else there. So that's an option as well. Although usually that would start at about 30 million yen, so about 300,000 at best.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Our pleasure. And Jamiel or Jamil?
Yeah, it's Jamal. I have a question, but I also wanted to say something for the Americans in the room. I'm not sure if Thad, I hope that's how you pronounce his name, if Thad is still listening. But
yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. So for Americans, it's really important to know that whether you're living in America and plan on going back to the U.S. or just keeping your living in Japan and planning on going back to the U.S. or keeping your American citizenship at all, you still have to pay taxes in the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
If you do invest in a property in Japan, it would probably qualify as a PFIC passive foreign investment company, which means that the taxes would be pretty high on an investment in Japan for property.
Well, I mean, but Japan and the U.S. have a tax treaty,
so I wasn't aware of that. I'll certainly look into that more closely. I appreciate that. Thank you, Jamil.
No problem.
Jamil, just to clarify that, I think because Japan and the U.S. have a tax treaty in place, then you would first be paying all of your tax dues in Japan, and then only the difference you'd be paying the tax on in the States. Is that correct?
It's actually really complicated. So if you're living, I'm actually living in Japan right now, and I've been talking to financial advisors, which is why I know this. It's not like I personally researched this, but the financial advisor is American, and he was informing me that, and I'm also, applying for my taxes in the U.S. But for the most part, if on your salary from a company that you're working at, you have to file taxes, but you don't have to pay for the taxes in Japan, in the U.S. So as far as filing, you just have to pay for filing, and you wouldn't have to pay taxes for your salary. But any investment, like extra money, not including income, including stocks, you would actually be, because you're taxed in the U.S. for all investments, you would have, if it's a foreign investment, it'd be considered PFIC, which is like the highest tax rate that you can get in the U.S. And if it was, for example, stocks, if you're investing in American stocks, then it would just be taxed like a normal stock investment.
Yeah, well, what I mean is that, okay, let's say, for example, your income tax in Japan, you're paying, depending on your salary and investment income, your income tax in Japan would be, for example, you'd be paying, 20 or 30%, and in the U.S. you'd need to pay, because of that structure you've described, you'd need to pay 40%, but you're not going to be paying twice, right? So you'd be paying what you owe to Japan.
Okay, I think from my side, I can hear you. I think from my side, I'll be able to do some research and just learn more how the tax treatment of investing in foreign income, like in Japan. I think I was just, my question was very exploratory, so I was still really just understanding the dynamics, and I got enough information to get and gauge interest. But I think the next step would be to do a lot more detailed analysis, and what you said, Jamil, is very helpful. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
No problem. It's something that I just learned recently.
All right, so go for it, Jamil, your question.
Yeah, so I think it was Emil who was talking, everyone was talking about it, but from my understanding of what you said is, if you got a house loan for a residential that you plan on living in, there's no issue, but if you planned on moving out of that residence, whether it be abroad or at a different residence in Japan, you would have to notify the bank, and then you'd have to pay the loan off in full. Is that what you're saying?
So I'll explain the scenarios. In general, personal home loans are very favorable terms. for you. They are almost 100% financing or even 105% financing, which means the bank will pay for the entire property plus closing costs in some cases. Okay, so there's no very little outlay from you. And the interest rate is about 0.6%, 0.7%, or even lower we can get. So it's very favorable terms. In contrast, an investment loan, you'll need 20 to 40% deposit, and the interest rate will be closer to 2%, 2 to 3%, okay, or maybe even 3.5. So the fact that it's a home loan, a due type of loan, is very, very cheap, okay? Now, in let's say you were to buy your own personal home and then move out, you know, be it a different property in Japan or go back to the States. You've now got and you want to rent out your house that you had or your apartment, whichever. You now have a investment property, but the loan backing it is designated as a home loan, okay, not an investment loan. The bank generally, in the bank contract, says that if you're not going to need to live in it, if it's not used for final residence, then it will be, you need to either pay off the loan or the loan conditions will change, right? Maybe the interest rate will change, etc. I don't have any experience of that happening. So, but in my Google research, what I have seen is there are three scenarios, okay? One scenario is they will keep even if you've moved out, they won't change the interest rate or nothing happens, right? You keep the low interest rate and you just keep paying off the mortgage as normal. The second scenario is they ask you to repay the loan in full. So generally that means you need to sell the property. Or the third option is, the third scenario is they will increase the, change the loan to an investment type loan and the interest rate will be higher. And I don't know if you'll need to pay in some equity or not. I'm not sure about that. And anecdotally online, what I've read is the situations where it happens that if the person has moved out for either work has changed and they need to go to a different area, but they plan on maybe returning back to the property at one time and making it their home, then the banks don't do much. They will just turn a blind eye to it. Okay. Then the situations where you have, and that's even if you rented it out, right? Or even if you've moved overseas and you want to come, but you think, oh, you know, I'm living here for a bit, but my home is still in Japan and I plan to come back in a few years' time. So I'm just renting it out so it can pay off some of the mortgage in the meantime. Then the banks haven't done anything. The situation where the person has actually lied to the bank. They said it's for a home, but from day one, they rented it out. Okay, so they've never even lived in it themselves, and the intent was never for them to live in it themselves. Then the bank has gotten upset that they were deceived to begin with, and that's when they changed the loan conditions or asked for it to be repaid. And the third scenario where the bank has been unhappy is when, generally, if it's a wooden house, and after you've moved out, let's say you've changed it to, like instead of being a one house, you've divided and you've made a one LDK downstairs and another two LDK upstairs. And you've now changed the structure of the property such that it's two separate residences. Then they don't like that you've changed that because you can't go back to it. It can't be back to your home. You've modified it to just increase the rental return. So that's the cases where they'll ask you to pay back or change the interest structure. This is just anecdotally what I've seen online, what I've read online. In practice, I don't know anyone who's had the interest rate change on them or any. I don't know anyone who's had anything actually happen to them. They just carry on paying the mortgage as is.
Okay.
I hope that answers the question.
Yes, it is. But I have a little bit of a follow-up question, if it's all right.
Yeah, go ahead.
So if I was thinking about investing in a property in Japan, then it would be better to, if I don't plan on changing my residence or home to an investment property, it would be better to just get an investment loan straight from the beginning with a 20% down?
Yes. Yeah. So if you you mean you want to you want to just a pure investment property?
Like I was thinking in the future. Then I was also, you know, like in New York, it's really simple to just buy a house, and when you lived in it for a while and saved up enough money to invest in a property, you change that into a rental and you buy a new property. That's kind of like the common practice. Mm-hmm. But in Japan, from what you were telling me, I mean, I could chance it, but it would be better to probably just save up the money and buy a separate, or get a separate investment loan to buy an investment property.
Okay, that's a tricky question. No, hold on one sec, my headphones batteries are dying. Wait.
Come on, Emil, you're just dodging the question.
Cool, all right. So that's a tricky one. Often an investment property and your primary residence are two different beasts. Like just the size of the value, the dollar value of it is going to be significantly different. Okay, in general. How much the bank will loan you. So, you know, if you can get, generally a bank for your personal home, a bank will loan you about 7 times your gross annual income. So if you earn, say, 7 million yen, the bank will give you 90 million. The bank will give you 45, almost 50 million yen. So 7 times 7 million yen annual is about 49, say 50 million yen. Let's play with that number. So for your primary residence, you can borrow about 50 million yen. Without any money down. If you want to buy an investment property, the bank can give you sort of, will give you a bit less to begin with because interest rates are higher. They'll want a down payment of 20%, so that's another 10 million yen deposit. So instead of getting 50 million yen, a 50 million yen property with very little money down at 0.7% interest, you're going to get maybe a 40 million yen property with 10 million yen down payment. Right, so it's completely, it's quite different, the kind of property that you get. So if you're going to buy an investment property, chances are it's not going to be something that you could also alternatively use as a primary residence. Okay, you probably wouldn't want to live there.
Unless you're a backpacker and you're just coming into Japan with a lot of cash and you want to splash it around.
Yeah, but we're talking about financing, right? So the fact that you can finance means you're working here. Right, you're resident here, and you're employed here, and if you are eligible for finance to begin with. So if you're deciding should I get a home loan or an investment loan, then you probably live here and work here. Otherwise, you wouldn't be talking about these loan opportunities. So the kind of property you're allowed is different, and then and what you can buy through financing, an investment property will be more money, more cash required, and less funding available with higher interest rate. Okay, so all right off the bat, you're looking at two different scale of properties. Right, one's 50 million, one might be 40 million with 100 million yen down. That's right, with 10 million yen deposit. The other thing to consider is this is an important one. If you buy an investment property first, let's say you buy a 20 million yen investment property. So you have a 20 million yen loan, right? And you've paid whatever necessary cash, but your actual outstanding loan is 20 million. When you want to buy your primary residence, right? And again, just say your income, the bank says, we'll give you 50 million. Hold on, you already have a 20 million yen investment loan. So we're only going to give you 30 million. Generally, we'll give you 50, but you've already got an outstanding 20 million yen loan. So your buying capacity is now 30. So now you can only buy a property that's 30 million. So by buying the investment property first using financing, you've sort of shot yourself in the foot by being able to and reduce the amount you can leverage this great the home loan, which has great terms. Does that sound clear?
It does, but does that work and the vice versa as well? With the you buy the home first. And then when you go for the investment property, the amount of money that they'll loan you for investment is also cut.
Yes, yeah, exactly. It does work opposite the same way. So let's say you buy the 50 million yen property first, and then you want to buy an investment property. The bank will say, well, you've already maxed out your 50 million. You don't have much capacity to borrow extra. So yes, it does work. But my approach, right? And look, it's personal preference for everyone. My take is I'd rather get the 50 million yen loan, which is 100, like no cash money out of pocket or very little cash down, at 0.7% interest rate, and miss out on the 20 or 30 million yen loan at 2.5% interest rate with only 80% financing. I'd rather miss out on that investment loan and maximize this great home loan than the opposite. I don't want to miss out on a great home loan opportunity by having an investment loan, which is not very attractive terms, relatively speaking. So, but that's all personal preference. So yes, you're right. And that's my take on it.
Okay, thank you for answering that question. I have more questions, but I'll just let other people go.
Okay, sure. Yeah, if anyone else, if Raymond or Asa wants to ask, we can, we'll open up to them. But then, yeah, Jamil, I think, yeah, you may, like, your questions are relevant, and I think they're also interesting to other people in the audience. So we'll definitely get back and see where you want to explore with that. But Raymond, hello. What question? Happy to answer any question you may have.
Yeah, had to find that mute button. I didn't have a later on offline, Emil. There's some things I want to talk to you about. But
sure.
Some of the questions that I, one of the thing I wanted to talk about earlier with Ziv is, it was really more around if people are looking at investment properties, why do people not move or tend not to want to change? In the years, on and off years that I've lived in Japan, I would say the cost, the initial cost up front, especially if the property is asking for key money, and I'll let some of the other people in the real estate who are more professionals or educated on the key money experience talk about it. But for example, the property that I'm in right now, I've lived here for 2 years to the end of this month, and it took 15 million yen just to get in. That's a big chunk of money, right? You know, 15,000 just to walk in the door. And it's going to cost me about 15 million to move, to live in an apartment with that first last deposit and a whole year's rent. It's estimated about 15 million in Chiba, which Ziv talked about Chiba before.
But 15 million yen? Are you talking about 150,000 US?
No, 15 million yen is 150,000, right?
Yeah, Raymond, let me ask, why is it a year's worth of rent? Did you say a year's worth of rent you need to pay up front?
Oh, no, I don't have to pay up front. I'm just estimating the cost.
Okay.
I'm saying paying rent for a year, first, last, and deposit with the rent and the, you know, the maintenance fee is 15 million yen. So
that would be 1.5 million yen, surely.
1.5, sorry, not 15, 1.5 million. Yeah.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
That makes more sense. Okay.
I always mess that up, yeah, sorry. Yeah. Not 15.
Yeah, so
1.5.
So I'll kind of just clarify. Oh, so wait, so what's your specific question?
My question, the whole thing I wanted to go back, and sorry for the tangent, everybody, was one of the reasons I was hoping somebody would elaborate for the other people on the call who are interested is, the reasons people tend not to move is, and this is my only two cents, is because when you want to pick up and move, it costs a lot of money to pick up and move, right? Even if the rent across the street is
so,
the price.
So definitely. So I'll explain a little bit to the audience exactly how it works. We do rentals as well. That's not my main thing, but our office, we have about 700 rooms under rental management that our agency manages. So we do lots of rentals. Okay, we have about 10 comings and goings a week just from the ones that we manage, let alone clients that do rentals with other properties that we don't manage. But I focus on purchases, but I have done a handful of rentals, and I fucking hate them to death for exactly the what you've discussed. Quite often, so there's the deposit you need to pay. That's 1 or 2 months.
Okay. Yeah.
1 or 2 months deposit. You should get some of that back, less cleaning fee. Cleaning fee, about 1,000 yen per square meter is reasonable. So if you have a 60 square meter property, then 60,000 yen, 70,000 yen is what you can kind of expect for cleaning fee when you move out. Okay, so whatever, and they'll say that, look, when you move out, you need to pay the 60,000 yen cleaning fee, and then any other damage that you've been caused, etc. The agents and the owners don't really make money out of this. It's not the business. It's really just straightforward, but the tenants always hate it. But yes, there's 2 months to deposit. Then there's key money, which is just the gift money you give to the owner that you'll never see again. And that's either 1 or 2 months, okay, is the key money. And then you'll need to pay, so up to 2 months deposit, up to 2 months key money. So that's 4 months right there. Then you'll need to pay 1 month of agency fee. So that's our commission as an agent that will introduce you. So that's 1 month of the fee as our agency fee. So that's 5 months right there. And then we have what often also happens is the now guarantor companies are almost always required, right? Especially in Tokyo, it's almost it's pretty standard. So you need to pay. It's like 2 weeks to 1 month of fee of debt for guarantor company. Okay, so that's 6 months right there. Plus, of course, you need to pay the next month's rent in advance. So although that's not a although you're still going to live there, it's kind of one of the costs that's required. So like right now we're middle of May. So if you get a contract now, like you want to move in tomorrow, you need to pay 2 weeks of May and all of June. Okay, so that's maybe 7.5 months worth of rent you need to pay right up the front. So if it's 150,000 yen a month property, that's 1 million yen you need to pay. And you're right, it's really expensive, especially the key money and the agency fee and the guarantor company fee. That's 2 to 4 months right there, depending on the key money situation. 2 to 4 months, which if you just stay in your current place and just do the pay the renewal fee, that's 1 month of renewal. So you can pay a renewal fee for 1 month, or you can pay an additional, essentially 4 months of lost cost just by changing, because you need new key money, new agency fee, and new guarantor company fee. So yeah, definitely, it's one of the big factors for where people don't move as frequently is because of the cost involved. You're right.
And if I could add one more thing to that consideration is if you don't work for a company that will pay for a moving company, and if you don't have a vehicle or rent a vehicle and move yourself, then you have to pay for, you know, like 0123, one of those other companies. And that's also an additional at least 100,000 yen, probably, you know, depending on how big or how much stuff you have, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, 100 to 300,000 yen if it's a full house. Yeah, or even 500,000 yen. I've had some clients do, but yeah, you're right. So there's additional moving cost there as well. And there's going to be a bit of overlap, maybe a few, like, say, a week of overlap where you're paying rent for your existing property and for the new property. Look, as I said before, I hate rentals. Why I really hate rentals? The cost is one aspect. Man, the especially with foreigners, non-Japanese or mixed couples, that amount that the guarantee company require of you, and I mean like in terms of the questions that they ask, how flawless you need to be with your employment, and then you're at just the behest of the owner and the management, the agency, a lot of places won't even consider foreigners. When you're looking maybe 200,000 yen and above, those kind of buildings are quite open to foreigners because they need, like, it's significant money, and they know that, you know, a lot of the expats or foreign nationals will have like higher incomes, which is pretty common. So they're more open to that. But anyone in like the under 100,000 yen range, they're like, well, there's heaps of Japanese that apply for this property. We don't need foreigners. So yeah, it's pulling teeth. And we can buy, like I said, with a home loan, we can buy a house for less money down than moving. So yeah.
And again, that's the only thing I wanted to highlight or kind of bring. I wasn't bringing it to the conversation. Thank you for speaking about it. Yeah, I just wanted to bring it up as it's been a personal pain of mine as of recently. But it's also something, if you're an investor or myself thinking of, you know, buying a property, going back to what Ziv was speaking about earlier with culture and moving, I feel that's one of the reasons why when tenants move in, they don't generally move out as much, you know.
Yes.
That's just my two cents.
And it's the same reason, yeah, you don't want to move, or you know it's costly to move. So once, because moving is so expensive, it's a bit slower to do. But like with a lot of our clients, like our rental clients, what we do is just 1 month deposit and maybe 1 month key money or maybe no key money. But what's common is 1 and 1 is pretty common now. If you want to get a tenant quickly, if you're happy to take to sit on the property and not get a tenant quickly, then 2 months deposit, 2 months key money is okay. It will just take a bit more time to find someone who loves your property that well. But if it's like just a mid or like a bit of an older property, older age property, then maybe 1 month deposit, 1 month key money. Or if you want someone to come in quickly, then just waive the key money. Of course, the rent can be a little bit higher. For the investor, they look at all the figures combined when they think of what they want their investment return to be. So it's like, okay, it's going to be rented out for 2 to 4 years at a time, and there'll be maybe a 2 or 3 month of gap vacancy in between, and I'm going to get this much key money and this much renewal fee, and these are the management fees that are expected and agency fees that I expected along the way. And so it's all part of the calculation. And if they are going to go ahead with accepting only 1 month key money or zero key money, then the rent needs to be adjusted so they can still meet their annual expect. Or like in Tokyo, mid 4% are pretty common, okay, for a moderate property. But yeah, if it stays vacant for too long because they want more money, then even though they're getting more key money, the overall the yield is going to go down because it's vacant for longer. But that's definitely something that the tenants, the owners consider. And they also consider, look, they've spent so much moving in, I want that higher quality tenant. Is also common.
It's also a matter of location and practices, and like Emil was saying, property profile. Like key money and thank you fees and all of those are a lot more common in Tokyo, for example, and in Osaka than they are in other cities. And also if the property is less attractive or there's more demand of comparable properties in the area when it becomes vacant, then a lot of landlords offer to pay some of the move-in fees or offer 1 month free rent or any sort of incentive for potential tenants as well. So it's more fluid in other cities is what I'm saying.
I'll give people a bit of some interesting information, maybe not so useful for you guys, but just interesting in terms of the rental market. What you see sometimes is 1 month free rent or 2 months of free rent. And you think, well, you know what, how about just forget about the free rent, just don't charge me the key money, right? It's exactly the same. Just don't charge me the key money, give me 1 month of free rent. And I'll pay rent from day one. But the reason they don't do that is because, or the reason they just don't discount the rent completely, okay, is because with their financing that they got, the owners with the financing have a certain expected return that they need to get on this property, okay? And that's based on what is that rent, what is the average rent for the building, and what is, and you need to maintain this kind of return. If they start reducing the rent, then the numbers aren't going to say we get this kind of gross return. But if they give 2 months of free rent, it doesn't impact the numbers, right? How long it's been vacant for doesn't really impact. In practice, it impacts, but for the bank's calculation, the financing agency, they say what's your rental you're getting for this property? And that's kind of the threshold, right? This is your rental, your yield based on just that rental figure. And so it's easier for them to give free rent for 1 or 2 months than to discount the rent. Or if they start discounting the rent or reducing the key money requirements, then the 10 other tenants in the future, they're going to say, hold on, this entire building now, they've been accepting 1 month key money instead of two. So that demand is going to change as well, right? For the entire build, that impacts other tenants in the building and future tenants as well. So they'd rather keep it higher at the beginning and offer free rent than we'd remove the discount the price or remove the key money. So that's my little just extra bit of information.
No, it was good. It's good. I appreciate it. And again, I apologize if my point earlier came off like a tangent.
No, it's very valid.
That's fine.
We actually, because we work with foreign landlords, all of our customers are foreigners, we actually instruct whenever possible, we instruct the property managers that we work with not to collect that key money or thank you money, because we think it's abusive, to be honest with you. But again, depending on the location and depending on what's the common practice in that city, we might not be able to find a property manager who agrees to let that one go. So it's a common practice that I agree needs to change, but it's taking a while.
Well, and I don't think we've even talked about, we just talked about the financial highlighted high level financial cost of moving. Consider the soft, if you're a business, you would say soft dollar cost, in the sense that as an individual, now you have to go to the new city office. You got to go to your old city office and say you're moving. You go to a new city office, you say you're moving. You got to update your address with all your financials. You got to go to the police station and update your address with your Zydeo card, and if you have a driver's license. So there's time involved with just updating. And until you've been through it, you're like, man, that's a lot of time involved. And that could be time away from work or time you have to make up somehow, right?
Yeah, that's very true.
That's why I love the house purchase, the amount of, I say, freedom, peace of mind you have when you own your own place. It's like, I know I don't have to deal with that ever again. I don't have to deal with a landlord ever again. I don't have to, like, worry about guarantor company or any of that nonsense, right? I want to, you know, just change the wallpaper, or I just extended my balcony. I want to have a barbecue on the balcony. And if any of the neighbors want to complain, hey, guess who they complain to? Me, because I'm the owner. The much upside. It's not just financial, just a peace of mind when you have your own place. And that's why I enjoy the real estate sales so much, because helping people get that peace of mind is, I know I've got it and I want to give it to other people as well.
Good stuff. Thank you.
Just on the cleaning fee, Emil, and Shikikin, the deposit is a service and businesses called Shikikin Busters. And cleaning, you can clean yourself. You don't have to pay that fee legally. And they can't force you to. And the regulations on what wear and tear is in this country are quite strong. So you really have to have trashed the place for it not to be considered wear and tear. And so Shikikin's should come back, your deposit should come back quite significantly. And I learned about that from an ex. We actually used it. And the guy came and he pretends to be or appears to be a relative or someone. And he just goes around and states the law whenever the inspecting agent tries to bring up that they're not going to get back a certain amount of your money.
Yeah, so the law, so I'll discuss that in about 2 points, right? So I don't do rentals that much, but now a lot of rental contracts will actually very specifically say, when you move out, it's going to be a 60,000 yen cleaning fee, and you agree to it in the contract. I think previously in contracts that don't have a explicit, it's maybe easier to dispute and say, well, the house is clean, I shouldn't have to pay for your cleaning service. But now it's very, very clear in there. This is how much it is, and we're going to take this from your repayment of the deposit, of the shikikin, of the deposit. So 60,000 yen is going to go when you move out.
Also, Jason, you're addressing this from the point of view of a foreign tenant, and I completely agree that more people should be doing this. But bear in mind that the typical Japanese tenant is very conflict averse, and most of them would not be pursuing these sort of things. They just pay up if they have to, or not move if they can avoid moving. And unfortunately, that's why the tenancy laws in this country are more geared toward tenants these days, because a lot of landlords have been pretty predatory about it.
And also, it's very clear now in the contract, this is, it states in items of important matters, it says, like, it's the Tokyo rule. It says, this is wear and tear. These are all the items that you can be charged that is not ordinary wear and tear, and these are the items that are considered not wear and tear. And this is what is acceptable wear and tear. Like, you know, a good one is, you know, a black stain mark behind the fridge. Okay, if you have a fridge there and it sort of stains the back of the wallpaper, then that's ordinary wear and tear. Pinholes in the wallpaper, like you put a poster up with pins, pinholes are ordinary wear and tear. A screw hole is not ordinary wear and tear. All right, and also depreciation. You have to, it's most items have a 6-year depreciation. So if you lived in a property that had brand new wallpaper when you moved in and it's been 6 years has passed, even if you've damaged the wallpaper, your kids have drawn on it, that you're not liable to replace it new for old, right? Because it's already it's had its full 6-year depreciation life. If you've lived there for 3 years and they say, hey, it's going to cost 100,000 yen to replace this wallpaper that your kid drew all over, okay, it's 3 years old, so you only have, it's 50% depreciated, so you're only liable for 50% of that. And that's very, very clear in the contract. The item of important matters has this whole thing described. So that's where that's being made more clear now in the contract as well.
Yeah, and to be clear, my experience is more than 10 years old. 11 years old.
Mm. Yeah. And look, I like the contracts because they are clear. And similarly with the cleaning fee, right? From day one, like it sets the expectation. So, okay, look, when you move out, it's just cleaning fee. I tell our tenants, don't vacuum, don't tidy the place. Like, don't leave it trashed. That's different. Like, take your trash out, but don't vacuum. That's what the clean 6,000 cleaning fee is for.
And on that lovely note, I think we've been at it for an hour and a half. So unless anybody else has got any questions and they want to raise their hand and ask them, we're probably going to wrap it up. Again, super deep dive into a very wide variety of topics. Hope this brought you some value at least. The Clubhouse Room, again, is every Wednesday, 1:30 p.m. Japan Standard Time. We're still trying to stream it on Facebook Live as well. We've had some successes and some spectacular failures in that particular department, mainly, as you've probably guessed, due to my severely lacking technical skills, but we will work it out eventually. If you want a Clubhouse invite, the platform is still invitation-based, I think. Feel free to hit us up and we'll send you one. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you are already in Japan on some sort of a more temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, and also if you're considering setting up a local company or branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiry, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com, and he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners and our clients. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, all one word, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating, review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, wherever you're tuning in from, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.